I'm Christopher Lydon with the Mark Blythe take on Occupy Wall Street. He is the political economist at Brown with a Sean Connery burr in his voice, who takes over the talk in a Glasgow pub as soon as he walks in. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. Mark Blythe, what is happening on Wall Street, inside or out?
Well, on the streets are very interesting things going on. I've been asked this a few times. Basically, my ability to talk about this stems from one event. I had lunch with a friend, Kevin Gallagher, and he said, let's go talk to these guys, and we did. It's a very interesting phenomenon. I spoke to people as different as you can imagine. I had a couple, sort of middle-class couple in their 50s, very concerned about their retirement, their savings, about what's going to happen, and they're very much Ron Paul supporters. They think there's something desperately wrong with the nexus between Wall Street and the Fed and the government and stuff. And much of that, I understand the concern. I think the diagnosis is completely wrong. And I spent time talking with them, and they listened, and we exchanged views, and it was very productive. Then on the other side, I have the anarchist left, who basically, unless you want to redistribute all property rights, abolish the state, and somehow emancipate total freedom, then you're a sellout. So I just don't really have that much to say to these guys. But everything in between was there and represented, and I think that's really interesting because this movement is spreading. It's all over the country. There's actually branches of it all over the world. And it's linked to a whole series of things. It's linked to the Arab Spring. It's also linked to the riots in London. It's linked to austerity strikes in Greece and anti-austerity strikes by workers there who are saying, why are we being forced to pay to save German banks from the bad loans they made? And the Occupy movement here is saying, why are we being asked to pay for a system that was bailed out by the taxpayer to a cost of $2 trillion, which since 2008 has awarded itself $2.2 trillion in additional compensation, while everyone has to take cuts? The only surprise is the fact that the movement isn't bigger.
Plus, middle-class people in Israel saying they can't afford to live?
Absolutely. There was a study today by the charity Shelter, which came out in the United Kingdom, saying that most rents in England are now unaffordable for 40% of the population. Rents, not house prices. Rents. That's serious.
So what are the links?
The links are, essentially, what we've done is to paper over some cracks. And the cracks that we've papered over here have been economic. In other countries like Egypt, it's been political. You take all the risks in the world, we've talked about this before, and you stuff them under the rug. So you like Mubarak because he keeps things stable. Why does he keep things stable? Because he keeps things stable. So you don't really care how he does it. He imprisons people, he shuts down dissent, he bans the Muslim Brotherhood, he bans expression. But it's great because he's our guy and he keeps things stable until they're not, because you can only stuff so much risk in the tail. You can only constrain so much of the natural volatility of a society before it blows up. Our similar thing has been to do this with income growth. There's a crisis of income growth in this country, and it's been papered over by credit. And that's why there's $56 billion of student loan debt. That's why there's $14 trillion of mortgage debt. That's why there's over $1 trillion of home equity line of credit loans outstanding. Because people have been borrowing against an uncertain future to finance an ever more expensive present at the same time as income has stagnated. Now, let's be clear about this. When I was actually at the Wall Street rally, somebody said to me, this claim you made that 40% of people haven't had a pay rise, that's nonsense. I remember 1979. Back then, I was earning like $5,000, and now your average income is $50,000. It's like, yeah, but you have to remember there's a difference between real wages and nominal wages. So at the same time, is it absolutely true that wages back then were much lower? So were the price of everything else. So when you adjust those wages for prices, when you look at the real wage, it's actually stagnant for 40% of the population. And for the next 20% of the population, it's barely edged up over 25 years. Meanwhile, the top 1% has increased its share from the late 70s from 9% of national income to 24% just now. You can't say that these things are not causally related.
Throw in the gap in income and ownership in the country.
Sure. I mean, the simple problem is this. It is ultimately zero sum unless the economy as a whole is growing. So for years and years, because of the credit pump that Wall Street enabled and the government facilitated and everyone borrowed against, we were fine. Let's remember, I think between 2003 and 2005, Citibank's slogan on television was live richly. You know how you're meant to do that? You're meant to do that with their credit cards.
I remember
it was all
that.
Credit, right? So you know, we're not living richly now, are we? Now, I arrived in the States 20 years ago, almost actually, well, not to the day, but to the month, And when I now look at the income and wealth distribution in the United States, I'm looking at the income and wealth distribution of Mexico in the 1970s or Brazil in the 1960s. This is not America. This is not a land of opportunity. You can't talk about opportunity when 60% of the population can't afford to go to college. There's no opportunity in that. Where the costs of basically a middle-class education far outstrip those of the average family. Where you have 54 million people living in a family of four on less than $22,314 a year. Meanwhile, the top 1%, as I've said, have trebled their share of income. Economically, inequality is a bad thing. Mm. You don't even need to make a moral argument. You don't have to mention the word justice once. More equal societies grow faster. They're better. Very unequal societies that are poor do a lot faster in terms of catch-up, and then they tend to get more equal over time.
This Occupy Wall Street movement really hasn't been named or framed yet. I mean, one, we are the 99% doesn't tell you much. What would it take to frame it around economic equality? That simple.
Well, I'm not sure that's the right frame. First of all, I'm not convinced that Americans want equality en masse. I think they like a little inequality. The evidence that we have, and there's a recent paper by a behavioral economist, I think it's Dan Ehrlich who did it, that took a bunch of Americans and basically offered them sort of different choices over income distributions. And it turns out we like fairness. We don't like unfairness, but we don't like equality. There's a very good reason for that. Some people work harder than others. Some people deserve the rewards for the risks that they take. I think where we get out of shape, though, is when we realize that the risks are being socialized and the profits are being privatized.
Right.
And that's what's happening on Wall Street. So I don't think equality is the right flame for America. America's not Sweden, right? Lefties can sit there and wish it was, but it's not. And you know what? I kind of like it that way. I chose America rather than Sweden because Sweden's a very nice equal society, but God, is it boring in comparison to the United States. So I like the dynamism in the US, but that dynamism has been drowned out by the fact that there is such a degree of increasing inequality in income and wealth that the United States I came to is no longer the one that I recognize. And that's very, very troubling to me. Now, how should this be framed? I'm not schooling these people. We will know when they know. Just as when the Arab Spring happened, people said, who are these people? What do they want? My answer was, well, you know, we'll find out when they know. And once they figure it out, they'll let us know. And this is going to be a long conversation, and it's going to be a difficult one because you've got everything from libertarians to anarchists in there. And the tendency is to look at the fringes, look at the extremes of the distribution. How on earth are Ron Paul people going to get along with anarchists? They hate the Fed, but everything else they disagree upon. And that's true, but why look at the tails of the distribution? Why not look in the middle? Why not look at the scared middle class people that are worried about the retirement that I met at that rally? They're the people that actually matter. They're the real Americans.
I love it that the movement doesn't have a simple answer yet, doesn't have a program. People knock it for that, but it seems to me this is kind of a process of fermentation.
It's a very organic thing. It absolutely has to be. I mean, think of the history of the labor movement, right? It's not as if the labor movement came sprung from the ground fully formed with collective bargaining and COLA contracts as its ultimate raison d'etre. People want you to remember that one of the early labor movements in the United States, the Grange, had as its motto, fear God, make money, be honest men. It's not exactly socialism, is it? And that was a very important part of the U.S. labor movement. The AFL-CIO split, craft workers versus unskilled workers. These are hugely contentious things. So the notion that these social movements pop out of the ground fully formed with 10 sound bites they can give to a reporter is just utterly ridiculous.
Much less a legislative program, for crying out loud.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, my God, the people, John Stewart did a good line on this. You want these people to have a legitimate set of demands that make sense? The government can't manage to get that together. Why would they get it together?
Speaking of the government, first big media, what is left of it, and big power, right up to President Obama and the Republican challengers, seem very squeamish about even looking at Occupy Wall Street. What are they thinking?
Well, one thing is I don't want to be associated with a bunch of anarchists who don't wash. That's number one. So it scares the middle
classes.
Well,
they love the Tea Party.
Yeah, they wash. There's a difference. I'm being slightly facetious, but there's an image problem with the left. The left is disorganized. The left is anarchistic. The left is a bunch of people who don't work, etc., etc. Stereotypes to be true, but very powerful ones. Whereas the Tea Party, the fact that, you know, it's bankrolled by the Koch brothers is, you know, hardly ever mentioned. But nonetheless, it's seen as an authentic middle-class movement. Now, to a certain extent, it is. To a certain extent, it's not. And then it's the same way that the Occupy Boston thing can be categorized as a bunch of hippies. But at the same time, that's absolutely not true as well. So we're working on stereotypes when we talk about these things. We're not talking about the thing itself. And I go back to why? Because they don't know who they are yet. So any attempt to have a discussion about what this thing is, what it means, it's just air at this point. It really is just air.
If those smart guys in the boardroom called you, Mark Blythe, and said, is this serious or is this just...
Oh, I tell them it's very serious. Now, it may be that the Occupy movement dies out next week. Right, that might happen, right? And you've got to go through a cold winter. Let's see how long that lasts when you're doing it outdoors in a tent. So there's lots of reasons that this might end up not working. But let's remember, in New York last week, hardly picked up by the media. So was it 700 airline employees, pilots, the whole lot, in full uniform, marching around? You know, this isn't a bunch of hippies, anarchists, and people who smell bad. These are airline pilots. These are professional people. This is tapping a deep sense of something's not quite right. When you've got airline pilots who are comparatively well paid showing solidarity with people because they too think that someone has gone wrong in the returns to risk and reward, then the guys in the boardroom have a real problem. Now, they have another problem. As I've mentioned before, I think their business model's dead over the long run. The whole trading side of banks is going to shrink drastically. So then that alone might actually force a rapprochement between Wall Street and Main Street. They're going to have to make their money the old-fashioned way by investing in real things. But in the absence of that, there's a problem. Now, there's a big problem for the United States in this regard because politics is run by money, which has been exacerbated by the recent Supreme Court decision in this regard. So essentially, if you look at what's happening, and Matt Taibbi pointed this out in his recent piece in Rolling Stone, you have all these attorney generals around the country that are basically being persuaded strongly by the Obama administration to sign on to a mortgage settlement, which basically takes all of the complaints, all the malfeasance, all the fraud, sticks it in a can, buries it in the ground, digs up the ground, fires it in a rocket and pushes it into space so we can all move on. This is the price of Wall Street giving him enough money for Obama to win the next election. And if he doesn't do it, they'll give it to the Republicans. They don't give a damn.
They win.
They win either way.
Speaking of rapprochement, can you imagine a bridge between Occupy Wall Street and the Tea Party built somewhere around a sentimental notion, but it's real, that, like, this can't go on. We're just too deep in debt. We've given away too much of our manufacturing, our good jobs. Stop the music.
Yeah, I can, but to the extent that we are actually talking to each other and we're not stereotyping each other. And if the prevailing image is Occupy Boston's just a bunch of unshaved anarchists, blah, 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 then you miss the Tea Party people that are already there who are part of that conversation. And if you say that the Tea Party is nothing more than a front for the Koch brothers and basically is just another right-wing conspiracy foisted on the left-wing public who really want more justice and inequality, but somehow Fox News stops getting there, that's just not going to work either. It's about having the conversation. It's about mutual respect. And one of the most unfortunate things of the politics of the moment is the respect has died. We define each other by what we're not. We argue against each other. We don't listen. Look at the blog comments people leave against anything that anyone says. The vitriol, the hatred, the anger. We need to get past that. Otherwise, the same people continue to win. So not only can I imagine a bridge, I can imagine a great deal of common ground because ultimately it's the same people who are getting the short end of the stick.
Can you imagine the person, the banner, the idea that would bring these movements together?
Off the top of my head, no. It's a complex story. One, end the Fed. Well, that's a great idea. Lots of private money. How are you going to pay for your iPad with Chris Lydon dollars? Right? Lots of private money. We tried that in America from 1830 till about 1870. It was an utter disaster. It took a civil war to bring a currency union. The place was a complete mess. You had to rediscount bills from Virginia when you were using them in New York. Is that what we really want to go back to? Oh, let's have a gold standard. That's an awesome idea. I like to call this chickens volunteering for the pot. Because you want to know what a gold standard looked like, look no further than Greece just now. Because although gold isn't being enforced, the deflation to adjust to the external balance that a gold standard demands, that's exactly what it looks like. So if people want to vote themselves into a culture of permanent austerity, why not go with a gold standard? So I think all this stuff is little more than sort of misinformed and borderline, how can I put it, malevolent misinformation designed to distract rather than inform. Now, as regards, what would we do then, Mark? You're so clever. Why don't you figure it all out? That is not my job, because I am incredibly nervous about putative intellectuals of any political stripe coming out with grand designs and saying, here it is, here's the master blueprint. Let me give you a good example of this as a master blueprint gone horribly wrong. European Monetary Union. Why not get the smartest technocrats in the world to sit down and design just one thing, a common currency for all these countries to use? And then we'll have a set of rules, and everybody will behave by the rules. And so long as they do, everything will work out fine. And you really have a set of ideas where you really believe that people are going to follow your rules. There are no surprises. There's no sort of like jumping out of the distribution here. Everything's going to be in conformity to your perfect little grand design. I don't care whether it's left, right, neoliberal, or whatever. That type of thinking is dangerous because those ideas are fragile against the world. They are too big. They're out of scale. They don't adapt. They break. They bring catastrophes. They don't enrich. So I'm not giving anybody the master blueprint. And whenever I see one, I run in the other direction.
It's early in this game, and we'll be getting our heads around it for a while, I think. But just roughly, what should we be comparing it to? You mentioned the labor movement, civil rights, gay marriage, civilizational
The Druid choice. Movement, I don't know, school choice. I mean,
but is it? Are we in Poland in 1980? Are we in Paris in 1968? All over the world? Oh. Is it bigger than a bread box? Where are we going?
Again, this is a way of thinking about it that I really try to avoid as much as possible. When something happens, it changes the conditions for what can happen next. We all know this, but we forget about it, right? So let's say, for example, you know, think about people who jump from bad relationship to bad relationship, right? So what do? You date a certain type. You're really drawn to the type. You know that they're batshit crazy and they drive you nuts and all the rest of it. You're drawn to a type. And eventually you go, I can't do that anymore. So what do? You go to the other type. You go to the complete opposite, right? So we know that people do these types of things behaviorally. And then what we're trying to do is essentially say, well, given that we do that and we've done that in the past, what's likely to happen in the future? Well, if you've got half a brain, you stop going for a type. You change the record. You change the program. There's been a labor movement. There won't be a new one. It will change its form and mutate. It may come back. It may weaken. What we find is labor movements all over the world are doing really well. One of the unintended consequences of globalization and the spread of industry around the world is, guess what? You're getting unions in places like China and South Africa and Brazil. That's what happens. And at the same time as they decline here, they're growing somewhere else. The civil rights movement was one tremendous movement that came out of seemingly nowhere, but really was a perfect example of the volatility constraint. You can only keep people down so much and keep pushing the risk into the tail before it explodes. And before that comes along at a moment in history where the United States really cannot pretend to be the world's leading liberal democracy and keep 10% of its population disenfranchised. You can't be a superpower and do that at the same time. Those conditions have changed. The future is always different from the past. So are there guides? Yeah, they might be a bit like something, but we're not going to know until it knows what it is. And then it changes the space for what can happen next. So keep watching, listen, talk. Don't try and define. It's not this, it's not that, and never can be.
Mark Blythe, you're one of a kind. Thank you. Welcome back.
Always a pleasure.
See you in Zuccotti Park.
Absolutely.
Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over until you feedback on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for being part of the conversation.